Do we want to do the intro first or just start talking?
We just start talking on True Crime 101s, don't we?
Yeah, let's go for it. Okay. We could just include this bit in it as well.
We forgot what we're doing.
Hey, guess what? We got a podcast.
I've had to sort of dust off all my tech from being away for the last 7 months. And if you guys, I don't know, heard somewhere on the internet, I don't know why you'd know this. Anyway. So I left. I don't know why you know that. Okay, starting again.
It's on the Daily Mail website.
I left the UK back in February, and we were doing Murder Friends while I was actually in Canada. So we were literally, you know, in different countries. And that was good. We were recording sort of through the pandemic, if you guys were listening, and all the craziness of like March, April, May, June, I think, as well. But we took a little bit of a break. And then kind of a longer break. but I think actually Anna very kindly suggested we have a little bit of a breather. I know for me personally, it kind of felt 2020 was kind of like everything that could go wrong most definitely did go wrong. And I certainly needed the break in the summer. So I am so grateful that we had like a little bit of a quiet time. And I'm grateful to be back, and we are back recording. This is going to be a True Crime 101, which I'm really excited about. And I'm thankful that people, I don't know, fingers crossed, actually will come back and listen, which would be really nice if you guys were waiting.
We missed you.
But yeah, it was just a shit show of a summer for me. I know you guys were having a rough one too. So it was really nice to have like a little bit of a break, a little bit of a breather. I watch so much Dateline. It's kind of embarrassing.
I started listening to all the podcasts, the podcast recording of the episode. I've been like binging them. Because I was like, I'd listen to the odd one, but like I started to like deep dive them now. Like they're my favorite.
I mean, I listened to one today. Let's be real. I listened to one today. Unfortunately, I think I've heard or watched all of them already, but because there's so many, you kind of forget how it ends anyway.
Yeah.
So that's that. We were gone and we were back. I did actually, I'll tell you what, I had a lot of people message me asking about Murder Friends. What's happening to Murder Friends? When is Murder Friends coming back? Which is quite heartwarming to think that.
Well, that's so sweet.
Good. Well, I hope they're listening. And thanks for sticking with us. It was, obviously, Atlanta, you've had a terrible year. And it was like, and I think everyone, it was just hard times. But like, I mean, nothing compared to what you were going through. But I think it just, there's a point where it gets really hard to talk about heinous crimes when you're going through shit. Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know what, this doesn't feel right now. So
it's not just
anyway,
the talking about the heinous crimes, it's all the shit that we do in the background. It's not just us sitting around having a chat and then we just like put our one recording up and then like put something on Instagram. It's like a shit ton of editing, which Alana was doing, and like with the website stuff and social media stuff and the planning and the noting. And it's just, it was so nice to have that break.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I think we would have just like burnt out and then never spoken. None of us ever would have spoken again. And that
would have been it. Burn all our notes.
Yeah. We're like...
just burn that friendship to the ground. So, yeah. I'm glad we're back and I'm glad that Alana's back. And
yay.
It's just been so nice to see her little face back in her house.
Back in my podcast tent. Which
you're in your tent, your little green.
I have a green screen that I use on Twitch that I repurpose as a tent. So we are back in our podcasting tents and we're ready to go. And I'm very excited for Hannah's True Crime. It's been a while, but I'm ready.
Yeah. I thought I'd come back with an absolute doozy as well. So,
I mean, it's the only way.
Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Welcome to True Crime 101 with Murder Friends, the podcast where three friends from three different countries talk about murder. My name's Hannah and I'm British.
I'm Anna and I'm American.
I'm Alana and I'm Canadian.
In addition to our longer episodes, True Crime 101 talks you through key true crime cases and theories. Did it all in one go without fucking up? Yes. So I think I mentioned this in our YouTube Q&A video, that one of the stories I'm fascinated most by is the List family murders.
Ooh,
heavy. You both know about this, right?
Yeah,
okay. So this is a long one, not going to lie. As always, sources. These came from Wikipedia, Murderpedia, Medium.com, New York Times, Forensic Files, yes, now.com, and allthat'sinteresting.com. This is going to be really monstrous, and I'm really sorry. So, John List and his wife Helen lived in a huge 19-room Victorian mansion with their three children, 16-year-old Patricia, 15-year-old John Jr., and 13-year-old Frederick. This property was so big that it had its own ballroom.
Wow.
It was called Breeze Knoll, and it was Helen List's dream house. It was in an expensive part of New Jersey, and it was one of the most expensive properties in the area. John's mother, Alma, also lived at the property in a self-contained apartment on the third floor. This is how big this fucking house was. It's unbelievable. And she moved into the property when it was bought 6 years prior. She lent John a portion of the money that they needed to buy the house. So the List family lived a pretty reclusive lifestyle at Breeze Knoll. They didn't really socialise, they didn't really get involved with the community. From the outside, they were seemingly living like this perfect life in 1971, but things were, I'm going to go for one cliche here, things were far from perfect.
Also, they had a ballroom. Like, I'd be having bowls all the time. A lot of bowls.
When you turn one of those, like, 19 rooms into just, like, a room to put ball gowns in.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
And then it'd be like Tuesday. I'm just going to put on a fancy dress and have walks.
Yeah, why not?
So let's go back to the beginning. John, who was born in Michigan in 1925, met his wife Helen at Fort Eustis, a military base in Virginia, in 1950. John had enlisted in the army in 1943 and served as a lab tech. Oh God, I typed that really badly. I didn't type lab tech. I put lavatory technician.
Like the lavatory? So sorry. Like, does he hand out the towels in the bathroom?
Yeah, he does. So he was discharged from the army in 1946. He did a bachelor's in business administration and a master's in accounting, but he was recalled to military service in 1950 as the Korean War was firing up at that time. Helen lived on the military base as her late husband had actually been killed in action in Korea. She had a daughter with him, with her former husband, and she was called Brenda. So there is some speculation here that they married very quickly because Helen told John that she was pregnant. John had a really, really religious upbringing and was a devout Lutheran. Lutheran. And as a result, he kind of proposed marriage. Shortly after their wedding, though, Helen revealed that she wasn't pregnant. As I said, John was super religious, and despite feeling tricked, he couldn't divorce her due to his beliefs.
Oh, Helen.
This, however, didn't stop them banging out three children pretty quickly. Brenda, Helen's daughter, moved out of the family home in 1960, but he had these three other kids with Helen. So John had previously struggled to hold down a job due to personality differences with his employers, and had, 6 months prior to the murders, spoilers, lost a very prestigious job as a vice president of a bank in New Jersey. He'd struggled to find alternative employment, but every morning he pretended to go to work. He'd get on a train and he'd come back at home time.
God, that's so eerie.
It's so dedicated to, like, the lie. Like, that's the scary part.
Or, like, taking that empty briefcase out of the house every morning. So money troubles were probably coming at him thick and fast. He started skimming funds from accounts held by his mother to try and meet his expenses. But by 1971, he was on the verge of bankruptcy. As I mentioned earlier, John was a devout Lutheran, and some Lutherans believe that being poor is a sin. A person should be working hard towards not being poor.
Okay.
All right.
It's just, wow.
Just don't be poor.
Yeah. I don't remember that in the Bible. God's like, stop being poor, y'all.
Jesus was like, ugh, poor people, gross. Yeah. Please. Money, however, wasn't the only problem for John. His wife Helen revealed that she'd been diagnosed with tertiary syphilis in 1968-1969, and her health was deteriorating. The vision in her right eye was fading, she was experiencing blackouts, she was falling. She even stopped going to church, which again was another blow for like John's devout belief system. And she also started abusing alcohol and tranquilizers. As if things can't get any worse, Patricia, his eldest daughter, she wanted to be an actor. She had this huge interest in drama classes at school, and there'd been allegations that she'd been smoking marijuana and practicing witchcraft. The sinfulness
sounds like
of
fun
modern
to me.
I know, that sounds like the ideal. I mean, I'm not going to lie, that was probably actually my teenage years.
Yeah, same.
Apart from the drama classes, because I'm not.
No, just the witchcraft and the
yeah, just
smoking.
The witchcraft and the. And the, yeah, we're not going to go into that. shit. The sinfulness of modern 1970s America became an increasing concern for John as well. So religious beliefs, wife's erratic behaviour, the threat of the 70s America having a negative impact on his children, and he does the exact opposite of what a normal human being would do and decides that everyone has to die.
Jesus.
So, and he'd just leave and start living the life that he wanted. He can't kill himself, after all. This is against his beliefs. And it would plunge his family into poverty.
But wait a minute.
Oh my God.
I mean, there's an obvious, like, contradiction here.
Just don't be poor. Whatever you do, don't be poor.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So if he killed himself, his family would be in poverty, and that's the sin.
Yeah,
so he thought, I'd just kill him.
So he's, yeah, so I'm just going to be a murderer instead.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know how he logically got to that place, but sure. Okay.
I'm going to tell you exactly how he got to.
Okay, you tell me.
I'm going to tell you the exact next steps he took. Okay. Because they are unbelievable. So, 9th of November, 1971. The children all leave for school. Helen comes downstairs for her morning coffee. John shoots her once in the head, killing her instantly with his 9mm automatic pistol. He puts her body in a sleeping bag and drags it to the ballroom.
I mean, I guess they weren't using it for anything.
Probably not a ball at that point.
He doesn't really sound like the dancing type.
No.
Yeah, if he's so against, like, drama and stuff, I wonder how he feels about dancing.
Mm.
Next, he goes upstairs to Alma's little apartment. His mother asks what the noise downstairs was all about. He mutters a response, puts a gun against the left side of her head and shoots. John can't drag Alma down the ballroom, down into the ballroom, so he leaves her exactly where she fell and just places a towel over her face. So he decides that after killing his wife and his mother, there's admin to do whilst the kids are at school. He cleans up the blood from killing Helen. He later said that it was, quote, surprising amount of blood. He starts writing letters to children's teachers, telling them that the family had to go to North Carolina to look after a sick relative. He cashes in a £2,000 savings bond that belonged to his mother at the bank. This would be about $13,000 today. He stops their newspaper deliveries, he stops their milk deliveries, he posts the letters, and while he's at the post office, he stops a mail delivery coming to the property. Then he goes home, and he makes a sandwich.
What?
And he waits.
What kind of sandwich?
Oh my God, Anna.
What would
What's
your mid-murder spree sandwich?
Exactly what I'm saying.
What would you have?
Go for like a PB&J? Did they go for a ham and cheese?
So disgusting.
Sorry, you can shut that out. It's so
he sounds like a weirdo, taste. So I bet it would be like an egg salad.
Oh God, like
yeah, with no seasoning.
Yeah, no.
Disgusting. That anyway. So he actually receives a call from Patricia's school. Patricia is unwell, and John has to go and pick her up. So he goes to the school. He collects her. He drives her back to the house, and once they're inside, he shoots her in the face with a .22 caliber gun. He drags Patricia's body into the ballroom and places her next to her mother. He comes out of the ballroom, he goes back to the kitchen, and he waits for Frederick to return home. When he does, he shoots him. He takes his body into the ballroom and lays him with his mother and sister. Despite killing four people at this point, John then gets in his car, drives to his youngest son, middle child, John Jr.'s soccer game at Westfield High School. He watches his son play his game. He takes him home. And upon entering the kitchen, John shoots John Jr. in the back of the head. Everyone else had kind of like fallen immediately, but it suggested that John fought back. John actually ends up shooting his son 9 more times.
Oh my God.
And then he drags his body into the ballroom. After saying a prayer over the bodies, John cleans up as much blood as he can. He makes himself dinner. He sits at the dinner table. He eats his dinner.
Oof.
He washes the dishes in the kitchen and puts them in the dish rack. He then goes to bed. And he goes to sleep.
Oh my God.
He actually said it was the best night's sleep he'd had in a long time.
Oh my God.
What a monster.
I don't think I'd have a good night's sleep in the same house where the dead bodies of your entire fucking family are.
No, hashtag ghosts.
How could you sleep?
He was serious. Yeah. Especially fresh in a ghosts. House that big.
So the next morning, he wakes up and he writes a 5-page letter to his pastor. And I'll put a link on the website with the full letter. And I don't know if I'd never really like heard much about the letter, but this thing is bananas. So it starts off, "Dear Pastor, I'm sorry to add this additional burden to your work. I know that what has been done is wrong from all that I've been taught, and that any reasons that I might give will not make it right. But you are the one person that I know that while not condoning this, will at least possibly understand why I felt that I had to do this." End quote. The letter continues onto the list of the 4 reasons why he committed the murders. And I think the order which John puts them in shows the ones that he think were the most important first. So the first thing he cites are the family's money troubles. The second, the effect that it would have for the family to go on welfare or benefits. Thirdly, it was Patricia's wish to go into acting and how it would affect her religious beliefs. And lastly, he states that his wife wanted to take her name off the church's roll and the effect that this would have on the children's attendance at church as well. In an effort to explain why he killed his mother, he simply says, quote, "Of course, mother got involved because what I did to my family would have been a tremendous shock to her at this age. She was 84. Therefore, knowing that she is also a Christian, I felt it best that she be relieved of the troubles of this world that would have hit her." End quote.
How thoughtful of him.
Yeah, I think it's thoughtful. I think it's, you know, make a sandwich, God. Sleep in the house with your dead bodies and mate. Awful. He then details the funeral, the plot and cremation arrangements and says, "Please see to it that all costs are kept low."
Oh my God.
What a prick.
The letter then goes on saying how he'd like his possessions and the family's possessions to be distributed as the pastor sees fit. Then how he had actually planned the whole thing for the 1st of November, which was All Saints Day. And he attaches letters to be distributed to family members. He signs the letters off. This is the exact ending of the letter with, quote, "Please remember me in your prayers. I will need them whether or not the government does its duty as it sees it. I'm only concerned with making my peace with God. And of this, I am assured because of Christ dying even for me. P.S. Mother is in the hallway in the attic, 3rd floor. She was too heavy to move. John."
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
I didn't really know much about this letter, and I've read the whole thing, and it's experience. So,
oh my goodness.
Once he's finished writing this letter, he goes through the house and he hunts down every single family photograph in the house, and he cuts himself out of every picture. The last thing he does before leaving is he turns on all the lights, turns the air conditioning down to its coldest setting, puts on a religious radio station and very, very loudly, and he walks out the door and leaves. So the house stands silent for almost a month.
Oh, dang.
A month.
Because, yeah, well, they lived this really reclusive life. You know, no one, you know, he didn't really engage with the community. So, yeah, no one says anything. No one does anything.
Oh my goodness. Because he sent this stuff to the schools, didn't he?
Yeah. So neighbours start to note the eeriness of seeing the house fully illuminated, but there being absolutely no activity. That eeriness that started to increase when one by one the light bulbs started burning out.
Oh my God.
In the house. Patricia's drama teacher is concerned after a month. Patricia once confided in him that she was scared of her father and that she was scared that he would kill her and her family. The teacher just couldn't rid himself of this feeling that something was wrong, even though John's obviously sent this letter explaining Patricia's absence. Taking another teacher with him, they go to the List house. and the neighbours have been keeping a closer eye on the property since the lights started to fizzle out. And when they see two people wandering around outside the property at night, they call the police. George Zalesnik and Charles Haller were the first police officers to arrive, and after knocking on the door with no answer, obviously, they inspect the property and they didn't really think anything was out of place. And then the neighbours were like, no, they're like, dude, something's wrong. You got to get inside. You got to have a look. So the police enter through an unlocked window. They immediately notice that the house is freezing cold and that the radio is still playing some creepy organ church music.
Oh my God. Ugh.
Then they find the bodies in the ballroom. Then they find John's confession letter. They find the guns. They follow the directions in John's letter and find the body of Alma upstairs on the third floor.
After a month.
Ugh. Oh my God. Ugh.
So the police decide, I think we should probably try and find John List. But the problem was that John had a month head start on starting his new life. And also, John didn't really want to be found. The only lead that they had was John's car was found at New York Kennedy International Airport. But after that, John List was in the wind. Guess how many years go by with no progress and no answers?
20?
18. 18 years.
Good guess.
So the FBI decided that at this point, there was something that was just becoming popular that could help them find List. And that thing was a man. And that man had a television show. And it's a man we've talked about in the Adam Walsh True Crime 101. Yes. That man was no other than John Walsh, host of America's Most Wanted.
Good old John Walsh.
So following the successes of America's Most Wanted, the FBI challenged John Walsh to delve into this cold case. John Walsh recalled that he had received a petition and letters from the friends of John List's murdered children asking him to take on this case. And in 1989, John Walsh commissions Frank Bender, an expert forensic artist, to create a bust of John List. Looking at photos of John, he didn't get them all. Did not get all those photos. Mm. Frank aged the bust by 18 years, giving it wrinkles. And he even went out, and I find this so like, do you know when someone's like so into their job?
Mm.
Like, and they're just like, he even went out to an antique store to find duplicate glasses.
Wow.
Wow.
I was just like, whoa. It took Frank 3 months to finish the bust, and he then took it onto America's Most Wanted, and where John Walsh just shows it off to an estimated 22 million people. That's how popular it was.
I remember the bust. That's what I always think of.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you remember like seeing a picture of it?
I just remember, that's what I always think of. When I think of the John List case, I remember the bust that they showed.
So the famous bust.
Yeah, the famous bust.
Yeah, so tips come flooding in, and 20 of those tips come from Richmond, Virginia. One of those tips comes from the neighbour of a man called Robert Clark. This neighbour thought Robert looked a lot like this bust and noted that the similarities he had with John List, i.e. that Robert was also an accountant and he also that he attended church. 9 days after this episode of America's Most Wanted, Robert Clark, or should we say John List, was arrested. He'd been on the run for 18 years. After he left the house, he drove his car to Kennedy International Airport. He abandoned it there to throw the police off his trail. He then travelled by train from New Jersey to Michigan, then on to Colorado. He assumed the name Robert, Bob, Clark after a college classmate. He ended up in Denver for a period. He remarried in the end and moved to Midlothian, Virginia.
It's crazy that it only took 9 days from that TV show.
I know.
Never underestimate the power of the public.
He didn't go very far. Like, he ended up in Richmond, around Richmond, and that's not actually that far from New Jersey.
Yeah.
You're kind of like, leave the country if you're going to like...
Exactly. So after his arrest in June 1989, List refused to reveal his identity, but faced with all the evidence in the case and a fingerprint match from List's military record, he eventually confessed in February 1990, which is 8 months of just pure lying and pretending not to be someone. And it's like, the jig's up. Like,
yeah, we've got you.
We got you. We got you, babe. So there was a trial where the psychiatrist testified that John suffered from an obsessive compulsive personality disorder, but he was convicted in the end of 5 counts of first degree murder on the 12th of April 1990. He denied that he had any direct responsibility for the murders and is quoted as saying, "I feel that because of my mental state at the time, I was unaccountable for what happened. I ask all affected by this for their forgiveness, understanding, and prayer."
Ugh. Yuck.
Gross.
Disgusting.
So he couldn't even, like, admit in the end what he did was horrific.
Yeah, and that he did it.
And he did it. Yeah, it still wasn't his fault.
Because he was worried about money. But basically, the judge was like, no thanks, and says, John Emil List is without remorse and without honour. After 18 years, 5 months and 22 days, it is now time for the voices of Helen, Alma, Patricia, Frederick and John Jr. to rise from the grave. Wow. He was sentenced to 5 life terms to be run consecutively, which was the harshest punishment available at the time. Obviously, he's a douchebag and he tried to appeal. He argued that he had PTSD from his military career and also that the letter he left that was addressed to the pastor was a confidential communication which should not be admissible in evidence. The federal courts also did a no thank you and rejected both of those arguments.
Good.
He eventually expressed remorse, but it wasn't very convincing, saying, I wish I'd never done what I did. I've regretted my action and prayed for forgiveness ever since.
Yeah, he didn't sound that sorry.
Yeah, hard pass. He died in prison. He was aged 82. And I think that's it's a terrible story and it's heartbreaking and very sad. But as if it isn't shocking enough, the real kicker in this case is that in Breeznoll, in the house, there was a glass skylight in the ballroom. And it was stained glass. It was beautiful. And it was signed by Louis Comfort Tiffany.
What?
And it would have been worth $100,000 to the List family in 1971, which is $610,000 in today's money.
Oh my god.
And it would have solved all of the money woes John List faced, plus left extra.
Oh, I just scream into the void.
Yeah.
Mm. Breeznoll itself actually burnt down several months after the murders. I'm not sure how an empty house just burns down. Mm. I'm thinking ghosts.
Yeah.
Definitely ghosts.
100%. A new property was built in its place. But even today, parents told a reporter in 2008 that children refuse to walk past the property and parents themselves do not even want to live on the same street.
I don't blame them. It's
I know, like, it's just a location. And you can think of it in similar ways of, like, other crimes. You know, like the JonBenet house and stuff of, like, it would be kind of difficult to live in that. But the fact that you won't even live on that street, like, I can't even imagine how eerie that place must have been. Especially if it's massive, too, right? It's got, like, the haunted mansion vibe.
Huge. Yeah.
It's just so calculated and evil. Like, I can't imagine. It would be my worst nightmare, like, to take your own children's life. Like, I just could, no. It's, like, some sort of, like, next level shit.
It's the way he did it. He was, like, so methodical. Like,
but then he still wasn't sorry.
Yeah, and it's not like it was in the heat of a fight or an argument, you know, like someone reaches for a gun and in the middle of a fight. Like, he sat down and he just waited. Like, how fucking creepy.
That's what I mean. And then he made, like, a sandwich.
He had, like, a sandwich midway and then he, like, had dinner. And I also wonder what he had for dinner.
Exactly.
And then he went to bed in the house. Ugh, I can't, like, go to bed if there are, like, dishes in the sink. Like, could you imagine having, like, your... Oh, no.
No.
So that's the terrible murder of Helen, Alma, Patricia, Frederick, and John Jr.
Wow. That's, I mean, I don't want to say that's great, but that's... You've done a great job. There's a bunch of that stuff I didn't know. I had no idea he wrote letters or anything like that, or, like, stayed in the house.
Yeah, and I knew he did. I knew he wrote letters to, like, the children's school and blah, blah, blah. But I didn't know about the, like, 5-page letter to his, like, pastor. And I had no idea that I thought that he'd just, like, woke up one morning and just went round into, like, everyone's bedrooms and just shot them all. I didn't know that they had, like, a full day.
Yeah, no, I didn't know all that.
It's just... And the fact that he, you know, killed his wife, killed his mother, and then cleaned all the blood up, and then, like, went and got his daughter and killed her, and then... You know, went and go and, like, sat and watched his son's, like, football game.
Oh, God.
And then brought him home and then shot him. And he cleaned everything up. And it was just like, oh, God.
It's horrible. All right, so I think that's all we have for today. You can check out our website at murderfriends.com and you can see all our sources. We'll be on there. If you can email us, murderfriendspod@gmail.com. Any suggestions on True Crime 101s or things to watch or review, follow us on Twitter, MurderFriendsPD, and Instagram, MurderFriendsPod. We'll see you next time. Bye!